This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Charles Sennett, recently returned to Iraq to see how the situation had changed 5 years after the invasion and to gauge whether the success of the surge could hold. He was embedded with a unit that General David Petraeus feels is carrying out the strategy of the surge. Sennett also interviewed Petraeus in Iraq. They first met in 2003 when Sennett was in Mosul. Sennett covered the invasion and its aftermath for the Boston Globe. He's the Globe's former Middle East bureau chief and London bureau chief, and currently works on the special projects team, for which he's written about the difficulties veterans face after returning home. But now that the Boston Globe and many other newspapers have closed their foreign desks, he's leaving the newspaper business and starting a website devoted to foreign news. It will be called Global News. We'll talk about that a little later. Charles Sennett, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really good to talk with you again. Let's talk about your recent trip to Iraq. Why did you embed with the Army's 1st Battalion, 28th Infantry Regiment?
Well, I embedded with them because I wanted to be right in the heart of the sectarian conflict and where it's unfolded most dramatically and most violently. I thought it was the most important place to assess successes or failures or challenges ahead of the surge.
Now, how long has the battalion been there, and how has their role changed in that time?
The battalion's been there since March. When they arrived a year ago, you have to imagine from their point of view what it looked like. I mean, they really came into red-hot sectarian conflict. There are graphs that show a sort of thermal mapping of violence in Baghdad going back 1 year ago, and they would show Rashid, which is in the southern fringe of Baghdad, to be red hot. It was really the right in the middle of the worst of the worst. So when they arrived, they were not doing reconciliation or reaching out to the community. They arrived with what they call kinetic actions, meaning they engaged the enemy. They went directly at the units that were in there of the Shiite militias who were really pushing Sunni families out, and they were going at the al-Qaeda in Iraq or al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. And al-Qaeda in Iraq was finding a lot of support among a disaffected and really disenfranchised Sunni community. So they were fighting on at least two fronts in very serious kinetic actions. They lost 10 men, 100 were wounded. They had very intense firefights and engagements on a daily basis. And really, it wasn't until the summer, last summer, that they began to really see that they had made some headway and they could begin efforts toward reconciliation, to open the market, to get the families to begin to move back into their homes and to begin to broker deals with what they call the reconcilables.
What are the reconcilables?
The reconcilables are the people who they feel can be dealt with. They're people who maybe they were a Sunni militia member who was working with al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia but had showed an opening and a possibility for being someone who wanted to not work with al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, saw them as foreigners, saw them as people who had been influenced from the outside, and they sort of wanted to come in from the cold and recognize that the future of Iraq might be better off if they actually engage with their own community and get back to working together, Sunni and Shia, which is really a long tradition in Iraq, and one that the U.S. government, in very sophisticated ways, I think, in the State Department and in the military, is trying to rekindle that history. So that would be one example of a, quote, reconcilable. Another one would be, for example, a member of the Jaish al-Mahdi, or the Mahdi Army, which are the Shia militias. And those militias had community leaders who they had to seek out and try to broker a new deal with and stress upon them that they are going to come at them very hard as an enemy. But if they're willing to talk and they're willing to take part in the community leadership councils, that they would bring them into the fold and they would bring them into the conversation. And surprisingly, I think, this has worked.
Now, how much of this was a function of persuasion, the U.S. military persuading the militia leaders to participate in reconciliation, and how much of it was kind of buying them, paying them to participate in reconciliation?
I think it's both. I think it's persuasion on a genuine level of people are tired of the sectarian violence. It's like Iraq had had a black hole of what it would be like to be in a civil war, which they were in, with sectarian violence unfolding on every street corner, and to look down into that hell and say, do we really want to go there? And I think there's a genuine spirit of the community that wants to move away from that. But you make a very good point. They were also buying these guys off, you know, $300 a month to the awakening, which is the new word for the Sunni reconcilables or the people who've been brought in. And, you know, there's definitely an element of that, that they are paying people off. And I think that's what has the Iraqi people who I spoke to, including these people involved in reconciliation, concerned about whether or not this can hold. There are successes that are considerable as a result of the surge, but there is a question that looms over all of Baghdad, and it is a question that every Iraqi is asking themselves right now, and that question is, can it hold? And the answers that I found on the street were most Iraqis feel it can't hold.
Why not?
They feel that the dynamic that was opened up hasn't played itself out. There are too many displaced families. There is too much confusion within the government about what the roles are and who's going to actually deliver services. And within that confusion and chaos, there's a failure to deliver services. There's also corruption, which is causing a lot of problems within the sectarian divide in Iraq. And there's also just sort of the simple notion that the Iraqi army is not up to the task of controlling those forces that can lead back to the violence. So what I heard from a range of people, including U.S. military off the record, diplomats off the record, you know, people on the street, people like a Shia leader, a sheikh from Rashid, would tell me on the record very clearly, we do not think this can hold. And I heard the same thing on the Sunni side. I've heard the same thing from the Kurds. And I've absolutely heard the same thing from a very small, diminishing Christian population that feels very imperiled.
Is it because they fear that when the U.S. troops pull out, there'll be less security? Or because it's the U.S. troops that are kind of brokering all these agreements, and when you take the broker away, people will just start fighting again? Are they afraid that the money that's been used to kind of pay off people so that they'll participate in reconciliation is going to dry up when the U.S. leaves?
I think it's all of those things. And I think it's most generally, it's a feeling that the Americans are naive about where they are, that they've never truly understood the complexity of Iraq and the interlocking relationships within the different sectarian groups that are influenced greatly by the neighborhood, with Iran influencing the Shia, with the Saudis and the rest of the Arab world influencing the Sunnis, with the Kurdish north being greatly impacted by Turkey there on its border, not to mention Syria having elements of funding coming in with al-Qaeda in Iraq. I think all of that complexity and that picture is a puzzle that most Iraqis recognize, and I think they're right. The U.S. government didn't understand when it launched the invasion in 2003. It's never really understood. And even though it is trying right now to work very hard to deepen its understanding, and it has two people who are very talented in this direction, General Petraeus, the commander of U.S. troops, and Ambassador Crocker in Baghdad, both get it. They both understand it. But I think Iraqis look at the situation and say, well, you have the right men in place now, but it's too little too late.
So we'll get back to the conversations that you've had with Petraeus and Crocker. But I'm just wondering, like, what it's like for you to listen to the political debate now about what we should do in Iraq, if you think that, like in the primaries, for instance, is the political debate addressing the real questions?
I don't think it is addressing the real questions. I think the sense I have from coming back from my visit to Iraq and hearing the political story unfold again is that the political clock in America is ticking faster than ever on the Democratic side in particular. The military clock continues to click at its own inevitable pace, which is based on what General Petraeus would call the geometry of the battlefield. They have very clear guidelines and standards and capabilities for building this down, which they are moving toward. In July, the surge troops will not be replaced. They will go home and they won't be replaced. That will bring Iraq down to the pre-surge levels of 130,000 troops. That's an inevitable force of planning that is underway and going to happen, according to General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker. Beyond that is a period of what they call assessment, weeks or months, as they told me, in which they want to really look at the successes of the surge and make sure they can hold at pre-surge troop levels. But beyond this very fast-ticking political clock and beyond the very steady-ticking military clock is a whole different time zone, which is Iraq, which measures time in centuries, not news cycles. And I don't think either one of those clocks, the political clock or the military clock, have huge significance in the long-term way in which Iraq's history is going to play itself out. And I think it's naive on the part of both the political process in America and the military to think that they can somehow affect that. I think they have effect, but it's minimal.
I think that's why a lot of people are saying we could stay there forever and these grudges and long time, you know, wars will still exist, so why not just kind of get out?
Exactly. And I think that that is a understandable impatience with the complexity of where we are and a timeless sense of what it is. I think I can also, just as a reporter, as a person who's gotten to know a lot of the soldiers and a lot of the veterans who are coming home and really listen to them, what I hear that really resonates with me is when they say, look, we broke it. We need to fix it. And I hear that on every level from people who are against the war, who have served in it, people who are very smart, who know the region. But I do think there is a very strong sense that I relate to and I feel resonates with me, which is an obligation to fix something that we broke.
Let's talk more about the trip that you just made to Iraq when you were embedded with the Army's 1st Battalion, 28th Infantry Regiment, which is a regiment that is in a zone where there's been a lot of ethnic fighting, and now they've kind of quieted things down, and the battalion is working toward reconciliation. You went to a reconciliation meeting between Sunni and Shia leaders. Tell us a little bit what that meeting was like. It was led by somebody from this battalion.
It was led by Lieutenant Colonel Pat Frank, who I compared to Tom Sawyer when I met him. He has that sort of freckle-faced, red hair look, and he is an amazing soldier. I had great respect for him, for his sense of a can-do spirit. He's got that sort of great American ability to say, we're going to try to do the best we can here, right now. You know, come help me paint the fence. And I thought that you could approach that with a great bit of cynicism if you chose to. I came to see in spending time with him and watching just how hard he was working, these endless nights where he's doing a combination of police work and social work, and basically trying to broker small peace deals and reconciliation agreements in the neighborhood. And I really grew to respect the efforts he made. And he led the convoy to Reconciliation Hall, which is what they call an old Baathist official's home, which has got all of the sort of Baath kish and the cut chandeliers, and it's all sort of dusty and once grand. And no lights work. As we walk in, they have to start up the generator, and it sort of flickers on, and they begin to sit down with these tribal sheikhs on the Sunni side and on the Shia side and begin to really hash out the nitty-gritty issues of bringing them together. And all of the cynicism I would normally have about this sort of approach began to fade because I could see that they were really working through serious issues like how do you physically get the families that have been displaced back? What are the problems that can ignite in a second when a family comes back and finds a Shia family in their home if they are Sunni? And how do you avoid those? And I heard them working through it block by block, house by house. And I think I was encouraged by it, frankly. I've been very critical of the war in Iraq. I've been very hard on the mistakes that were made. But I think that the efforts being conducted by General Petraeus on the ground with the surge are genuine, and I think they are having impact, and I think they're setting a sort of model, a standard, for the Iraqi people to find a way to move forward themselves through very local governance.
So give us an example of the kind of movement forward that you saw at this reconciliation meeting, for instance, with the problem of what do you do when, like, a Sunni family moves back and finds that there's a Shia family in their home or vice versa.
Well, they talked about a Shia neighborhood that had a certain member of that community who had been active in the militias, who they felt had really, who the Sunni side felt had really forced them out of their homes. And they said, look, we want to move back to our homes, but we're not going to move into homes and have the person who forced us out as a neighbor. That person shouldn't be able to come back. And there was a great, very lively, animated discussion about this. And it went into some detail. And they were looking for models that perhaps that person could rent their home out and not live in the neighborhood anymore where they had caused great damage. Or maybe that person should be investigated. And if there are grounds to find that that person did remove people from their homes and that he did do things that would break any kind of laws for any kind of democracy, then maybe that person should be locked up and detained by the U.S. forces. And you could hear within the conversation a very sophisticated, I thought, way in which the U.S. military would set the questions up for the Iraqi council and then step back and quietly watch as they tried to work it out and then maybe jump in and try to guide the conversation again and then step back. This is a sort of field initiative among people like Lieutenant Colonel Frank that General Petraeus has tried to really inspire. These are the kind of people who are going to make decisions on the battlefield that can't be directed from above. They're going to have to be split-second decisions and a very initiative-oriented leadership and command in the field. And it's really textbook for what General Petraeus had hoped to do with the surge, to take his most experienced battalion commanders and even sort of captains of companies and say, look, you do your own initiatives and go out there and try to make it work. And they're being very creative. They're thinking of things like naming it a reconciliation hall or having a joint prayer service with the Sunni and Shia to turn over the keys of a Sunni mosque that had been taken by a Shia militia. And that's the kind of creative work that I think we're not hearing enough about on the street. But to give a little bit of cynicism to it, I really pressed General Petraeus on that. And he conceded it is a little bit of Barnum and Bailey. As he put it, there's a lot of plate spinning. But he wants his field commanders to feel creative and to feel like entrepreneurs and to move toward reconciliation in any way they can find.
Well, one of the problems that you run into with reconciliation is, say, the Sunni militia leaders who have been persuaded or bought and are now participating in reconciliation, these are some of the same people, as you point out, who led the militias that chased out Shia from the neighborhood. So now these same guys, they're part of reconciliation and they're trying to, you know, make it possible for Shia families who fled to move back in. Why should those Shia families trust them?
Well, having covered counterinsurgency in a lot of different countries, I mean, you could say the same thing was true on the streets of Belfast when they began to broker the Good Friday Agreement. And it really was the people on the street who led the politicians to an agreement. You could also say the same thing in Israel-Palestine, where we saw people who were once right at each other's throats tried very hard to move forward to a peace process. Now, that did collapse. It was not something that succeeded, but it came very close. And I think in both the example of the Clinton administration's efforts in Northern Ireland and the efforts of the U.S. government that continue to today in Israel-Palestine, you see sort of bookends of what's possible. Good Friday worked because the people supported it and they were able to move forward and see that they could no longer call their neighbors enemies. They had to see each other as people who need to move forward to build their own communities. They were tired of all of the violence. They were ready to change. Israel-Palestine was an example of an attempt at reconciliation that was pushed by a political clock in America and in Israel, and that didn't work. And it didn't allow for the people on the street, both Israeli and Palestinian, to accept what it was going to be, and it fell apart. We should be learning from those two examples about what can work and what can't. And I worry about sort of the ahistoricity of our State Department and our military sometimes to not look back at these examples and really try to study them and talk openly about them. I think there are people like Crocker and Petraeus who think that way, but not enough.
On this trip to Iraq that you just got back from, you spoke with General David Petraeus, who's leading the surge, and you had met him before when you were covering the invasion of its aftermath. You'd already interviewed him several times before this most recent meeting. What's your impressions of if he thinks the strategy is really working?
General Petraeus is very careful not to be overconfident about the successes of the surge. The successes of the surge have metrics. I mean, violence levels are down. Killings of civilians are down. Killings of U.S. troops are down. And they're all down in a category of somewhere between 60 and 70%. I mean, this is a dramatic and precipitous and very considerable drop. And so he could be talking about light at the end of the tunnel, to use a phrase that came from the Vietnam War. But he will never do that. And he's very careful about that. And I think part of the reason he is careful about that is General Petraeus is a scholar of history. He wrote his PhD at Princeton on the lessons learned from Vietnam. And he keeps those lessons in mind every day when he's managing the message and trying to deliver on the surge. And he thinks, you can't talk about light at the end of the tunnel. You just have to build the breathing space. You have to create less violence so that the Iraqi people can decide to build their own institutions and move forward to build their own country. And in containing what he seeks to accomplish, I think he has a greater possibility of succeeding in what he sets out to accomplish. I think the big test for General Petraeus is coming, and it's going to come when he testifies next month before Congress about the surge.
And how is that the test?
I think it's the test because he's going to be asked to account for the successes of the surge, which he'll be able to point to, and then he's going to be asked what's next. And how he spells that out beyond the medium term, which is to say there needs to be a period of assessment and we will build troops down further based on what we see as an assessment. That will be the answer he gives. But I would predict there will be a lot of pressure coming from those committees. Both Republicans and Democrats, I think, will be asking, you've got to go further with this. Where is this headed in the long term? What do you think is wise? Do we need to stay in here for the long term? Are we really having successes that, if they do hold, what do you see as a time frame? And I just don't know whether he can, A, answer those, because it's hard to know what you don't know. I mean, there's a, you know, to use a phrase, there's a future out there for Iraq, and it's just built on unpredictability, and it's very difficult to try to navigate the way forward. But Petraeus is going to be pressured, and Crocker is going to be pressured, and it'll be very interesting to see how candid they are and how their testimony plays out in this very hot political climate of a presidential race.
Now, General Petraeus might become the top commander of NATO. Should we read anything into that? I always wonder, does that mean he's disillusioned with Iraq and wants to get out because he knows in the long run it can't work? Or is this just part of the normal rotation of, you know, positions in the military, that people don't stay in one place for too long, and when they're really good, they're going to be promoted?
I don't know the answer to that because we didn't talk about that. I talked to his staff quite a bit about those kinds of issues just to understand military culture. I'm someone who doesn't cover the Pentagon, but I've gotten to know General Petraeus really in the last 5 years and had a chance to meet with him at a lot of different points in the war in Iraq and different points in his career, which has been pretty stellar. And I've seen him, you know, when he was up and when he was down. And now that he's back up again, I would read into it this way. I would say that is not a predictable path for a general to take, to go from the commander of forces in Iraq to NATO. I think that what it suggests is an interest in refocusing the American military's attention on Afghanistan, where there is a very sophisticated counterinsurgency strategy. And General Petraeus has defined himself as the military's best and brightest on counterinsurgency. He rewrote the counterinsurgency manual, which needed to be rewritten. It hadn't been rewritten in 30 years. He brought a lot of understanding of history to it. And I think he really is equipped to take on the much more complex challenges of fighting terrorism on many levels, not just the conventional level of kinetic engagement, but on the level of how you, in very strategic ways, try to broker deals, try to play to the axiom of the region, which is the enemy of my enemy is my friend, how to look for opportunities for reconciliation. And he's very good at painting what he calls the white lines in the road and directing his men forward and trying to figure that out. And if I were to guess, and this would be a guess, I would say that General Petraeus would like the NATO command because he would be able to put those skills to use in Afghanistan, where I can tell you after spending time on the ground in Afghanistan, they are hugely needed. That is a theater of this long war, and I use that as quotes, that we are fighting where there is a great need for a much deeper and more sophisticated understanding among the military and the State Department of where they are and what challenges lie ahead. I think it's hugely undermanned, and I think it doesn't have the intellectual power that it needs to be able to succeed there.
So, you know, everybody's asking, can the successes of the surge hold? And the way that question is usually posed is, can it hold after the U.S. pulls out? Can it hold after Petraeus pulls out? Like, if Petraeus leaves Iraq to assume command of NATO, will there be anybody who can carry on with the kind of wisdom that a lot of people think he has applied in Iraq?
That's a really good question. I think it's a very profound question, because why is it that General Petraeus's command is locked into that one time frame? Is it possible that General Petraeus should continue to lead the surge if it needs to go further? And I don't know really whether or not that's possible within military guidelines for his command to be extended. But I do think that if the successes are happening, and it's moving forward steadily, should we as a country keep the person who is perhaps best equipped to do that in there longer?
You covered the invasion of Iraq for the Boston Globe and the aftermath. What's one or two of the things that surprised you most, the outcomes in Iraq that you just couldn't have predicted?
I'm not very surprised by the outcome in Iraq. I think people who'd covered the region for a long time, I'd covered it since the first Gulf War, and by many measures, that's not a long time. There are veteran correspondents who go back to having covered the war in Lebanon and further back. But everyone who brings some historical perspective to the region understood that Iraq is a tinderbox of sectarian conflict. And if that is opened, and it's not opened in a way that it can be quickly contained, that it will explode. And there were a lot of us who were writing in 2003 and foreshadowing that, particularly after we really got on the ground in, say, the first 6 months after the invasion in March of 2003, where you began to see the insurgency build up steam and you began to see it go off the rails. And I think since then, certainly, if not before, among some more senior writers, we've been predicting this, that this would happen. So I'm not surprised at the forces that have been unleashed. I am surprised by the intensity of it. I'm surprised by the ferocity of the sectarian violence. Where I am surprised in the bigger picture is Afghanistan. When I go to Afghanistan, you know, and I was there among the first reporters in September of 2001. We were among the first on the ground. I've checked in back on that story throughout the years, and I was last there about a year and a half ago. Excuse me, I was last there just a year ago. You know, I am surprised that in Afghanistan we don't have more troops. I am surprised in Afghanistan that we don't see we need to make that work, and that the successes we have had there through the provincial reconstruction teams are greatly imperiled right now, and that is slipping away from us. That is the point from which our country was attacked on September 11th. That is where bin Laden trained the forces. That is where we have to presume bin Laden could be, you know, in hiding just on the other side in the Pakistani areas. And why we haven't had a more sophisticated and aggressive fight there is, to me, the biggest surprise I hold when I step back from all of the reporting and all that's gone on since September 11th. And I just can't fathom how it is that we are not taking a much more serious approach to Afghanistan.
You know, in addition to covering the war in Iraq, you've also covered what it's been like for veterans who have returned home. And you've written several articles about some of the frustrations that they've faced. And one of those frustrations is dealing with the VA hospitals. What are some of the problems that veterans have run into with the VA hospitals?
Well, the VA hospitals are geared toward and have been shifted toward peacetime. You have to think of the sprawling network of VA hospitals as this vast HMO. And they had structured themselves to deal with World War II veterans. And that was all occurring under the Clinton administration and really even under the 41st Bush administration. This was a time in which the VA was being restructured and recast. They were closing the big hospitals. They were shifting their focus to sort of outpatient care. And suddenly the country is attacked and hit with a war on two fronts. And the wounded are coming home with unbelievably complicated wounds. And the system is not equipped to deal with it. People who work in the VA, many of them are very good people who care a lot about veterans, who want to work as hard as they can. But there's a culture and an institutional failure within the VA that is astounding once you're inside it. So you have a situation where the veterans who are coming home wounded, they get the best online medical emergency care that is offered anywhere in the world. When they land, when they're in the field, they get great care. When they're in Germany, they are receiving top-notch, top-flight, excellent care. When they get to Bethesda or they get to Walter Reed, the care is excellent. It's after they're done with acute trauma care that they're really falling off the map and falling through the cracks of a system that just hasn't figured out how it's going to take care of these guys. And why this isn't a bigger issue in the presidential race, I just can't understand. How you don't hear about this from both Republicans and Democrats, the outrage that we don't take care of our veterans the way we should, is something I can't fathom. I mean, you do hear it from Clinton. You do hear it from Obama. You can hear McCain, who, of course, spent a lot of time in the military medical system himself. But you don't hear it resonate out. You don't see it being covered. You don't see it being asked about by the reporters covering the campaign very often. And I just wonder why that is. To me, it seems like one of those issues we should be pounding down doors on, and I'm not seeing it.
Yeah, another source of frustration that you've written about for veterans is the GI Bill and mm-hmm. the promises that were made to them about access to education, which they don't feel the promises are being followed through.
Yeah, the GI Bill is probably one of the most historic pieces of legislation, right? It changed our country. We come out of World War II and we decide we're going to take care of veterans. We're going to give them an education in exchange for their service, or we'll give them loans to build a home or to build a company, and we will take care of them. And that was very successful. The return to the American economy on the original GI Bill was, for every dollar that was invested in the GI Bill, the country received $8 back, you know, when people went on to have great salaries and pay taxes and be successful in their lives and grow a family. Now, you know, we reach a point where the GI Bill was changed during peacetime to become a peacetime GI Bill. So the benefits were reduced. And now we are not a country at peacetime, although you can sometimes feel like that when you're walking through a shopping mall in America. You wouldn't even know there's a war. But for the families who have loved ones who fought in that war, for the men and women who are doing it, the war is very real. And the GI Bill doesn't cover their education enough. It doesn't reflect wartime service, I think. It really needs to be corrected. There's legislation being looked at to do that. But again, why isn't that getting pushed down the road much, much more quickly?
Charles, we've been talking about your reporting on Iraq for the Boston Globe and your reporting on veterans who returned from Iraq. There's some news in your life I'd like to talk about, too, which is that you're leaving the Globe and launching a new website for international reporting called Global News. And just before we get into what the new website will be, why are you leaving the Globe, with whom you've been for 15 years?
I'm leaving the Globe with a lot of sadness, but I'm leaving because they allowed me to go off and cover the world for 10 years. I was based in London in the Middle East, and I think I was very lucky to have a chance to do that. And then when I came home, they closed the foreign bureaus. They no longer have a foreign editor, and they no longer cover foreign news. And that makes me really sad to think that this great newspaper has shrunk its vision to the point where it doesn't feel, because of the economic necessities of what's happening in the newspaper world, that they can cover international news. And I think that's been true across newspapers in America. Baltimore Sun has shut down its foreign operation. Newsday has cut back. Philadelphia Inquirer, Chicago Tribune. You just keep going down the line. And all of those reporters who covered that are now wondering what happened. And I think our website, I hope, will be a chance to fill the gap, to say where traditional establishment news organizations have cut back or abandoned their mission to cover the world, we see a great opportunity. And we really want to try to flood that zone and fill that space. And we have a lot of underemployed foreign correspondents who can help us do it.
So what's your editorial model of how this would work and what it will look like?
Well, my partner, Phil Balboni, who will be CEO, has a business model, and I'm going to be the editorial head of the operation. And Phil's idea is a very broad one, to have 70 foreign correspondents who will be based all over the world and who will be paid a retainer in exchange for filing their stories. Now, that's not a new model. That's really a sort of stringer model that a lot of news organizations had used. But what we are doing that's different is we're offering the foreign correspondents a share of the company. We're going to be paying in shares as well and allow foreign correspondents to be entrepreneurs in the field and to think about the fact that they are vested in the success of this website.
You've had to deal with your own safety in the field, but this will be your first time as an editor signing off or not when a reporter tells you that they want to put themselves at risk in a war zone to cover a story. So I'd be interested in hearing about your thinking on the position you're going to be in, having some responsibility for other people's lives.
I take that very seriously. I've been in a lot of conflict zones with a lot of colleagues and sadly lost a few, or been in, you know, just very worried about colleagues like Matt McAllister, who was held at Abu Ghraib, or Jill Carroll, who was being detained and worked very hard in every way I could to help them get released, or to help the families of correspondents who died in the field. I mean, these are issues for this generation of foreign correspondents who've been in the field that we take very seriously. So when we have 70 foreign correspondents all over the world who are young, we want to also have a community of more veteran journalists who can also mentor them and talk to them about the need to be safe. You've got to first care about their safety, be sure they're okay, be sure they're not taking unnecessary risks, and use every bit of street smarts and intuition that you have as a more veteran foreign correspondent to communicate that to them, and I will work very hard to do that.
Well, Charles, it's great to talk with you again. Good luck with your new venture on the Internet.
Thanks, Terry. It's always great to talk with you.
Charles Sennett leaves the Boston Globe next month to start the Global News website. Tonight on the FX cable network, Eddie Izzard and Minnie Driver return in the second season premiere of The Riches. They play Irish-American gypsies who have adopted the identities of an upper-class couple and try to make the scam last long enough to pay off. Our TV critic David Bianculli says it already has.
The premise of The Riches is so wildly improbable that you have to suspend disbelief from the very start. But it's worth it. Eddie Izzard and Minnie Driver play Wayne and Dahlia Malloy, who are part of an Irish-American gypsy clan called Travelers. When the series began last year, she was being released from jail and fighting a drug addiction. They got into trouble with members of their own clan and fled, packing up their three kids and heading out on the open road. On that road, they were first upon the scene of a fatal one-car accident, which had claimed the lives of Doug and Shireen Rich. A quick search of the mangled vehicle uncovered that the Riches were on their way to a lavish new home they had bought over the internet, and a lawyer's job for which Doug had been hired, sight unseen. The Malloys decided, then and there, to hide the car and the bodies, become the Riches, then become rich. That's a preposterous scam to try to pull off, and there are dozens of reasons why it wouldn't work. What's fun about the FX series The Riches is that it doesn't ignore that reality. The scam doesn't work. Almost every week, there's a new wrinkle, a new threat, an old acquaintance. The Riches are in deep, and each week, the digging gets a little deeper. Take the second season opener, for example. Even before we get to the opening credits sequence, the complications escalate to a critical mass. Pete, an old friend of the real missing Doug Rich, has shown up in town. So has Dale, an old enemy of Wayne Malloy, who knows Wayne is now posing as Doug Rich. The family plan is to leave town immediately. But the youngest son has another idea, to offer Pete a hefty bribe to keep quiet about his missing friend. Wayne, played by Eddie Izzard, has an idea too, and springs it on Dahlia, played by Minnie Driver, just as they're about to gather the kids and drive away.
All right, get in the car. What's wrong? Get in the car.
I want you to grab the kids. Get the hell out of here. I will meet you in Galveston.
Wayne, get in the damn car.
I'm not going, baby. Got the 40 grand and the 7 grand we saved up. I'm gonna talk to him.
Wayne.
Like Sammy said, money makes the world around.
Wayne, he's a little boy. You're a grown man. There's things you won't, and there's things that are. You gotta know the difference.
I have to try.
Baby, you can't bribe Pete. Don't you get it? He's honest.
Baby, then I will buy you a little time and get you closer to Mexico.
Wayne, get in the damn car.
If anyone's going to prison, this time is me.
No, Wayne. Baby.
No matter how bad things seem, they invariably get worse. Wayne is always one slip away from being exposed as a fraud. Dahlia is one step away from being snatched by the cops for violating terms of her parole. Even the kids are in trouble, especially the teen son, who hates conforming to the new life of the Riches and just wants to treat everyone as marks and victims, the way he was raised to. Hardly an episode goes by without an eruption of awful violence, the threat of death, or an escalation of the body count. And yet, the performances are so delicious, the Riches is irresistible. As you watch each episode, and poor Wayne gets painted into a corner from which there appears to be no escape, you finally realize what's so compelling about this series. It's like a dramatic version of Fawlty Towers, that classic British comedy in which John Cleese would get himself into one horrible fix after another. The difference is, Wayne Malloy, as the new improved Doug Rich, keeps finding ways out of them. But I'm not sure he always will. On The Riches, you can delight at the complexity and cleverness of a scam one minute, only to be horrified the next when the con goes sour and the would-be victims react by drawing guns or swinging baseball bats. Violence in The Riches is sudden, unexpected, and realistic, and it's never far away. As the leading couple, Eddie Izzard and Minnie Driver are almost like chameleons. Sometimes they act like The Riches. Other times they adopt other identities. And even when they're alone, intimately sharing secrets and fears, they're still not dropping their guard fully. The TV show The Riches, like the characters The Riches, can't be trusted. No matter where you think it's headed, it veers off somewhere else. But it's a very intriguing place to be. As with The Sopranos, Dexter, and Breaking Bad, the wrong side of the law turns out to be where to look if you want to find the most interesting characters and the most entertaining TV shows.
David Bianculli is TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.